Looks like we have the other laptop hooked up. So moving on then, our next speaker today is Ginny Yingling, a hydrogeologist in the Environmental Health Division of the Minnesota Department of Health and department's lead investigator of PFASs. She holds a BS from the University of Pennsylvania State and MS from the University of Wyoming, both in geology. She has over 20 years of experience investigating contaminated groundwater sites in Minnesota, having worked previously at Twin Cities Testing and the Superfund and leaking underground storage tank programs in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The talk today is PFAS in Minnesota, an update on the chemicals formerly known as PFCs. Help me welcome Ginny Yingling.
It will crank this way down from John's towering height to mine. Well, thanks, everybody. Good to be back here. John gave us a view of the future. Here we are talking about PFCs again, or as they're now known, PFASs. And so in a nod to Prince, I've titled this The Chemicals Formerly Known as PFCs. And despite my best efforts to have a slightly darker dye to my hair, my hairstylist, who was a friend of Prince, seems to always want it to come out his color. So we'll be remembering him as we go. So for those of you who haven't been following all of this, I'll do a quick background on what these chemicals are, and then we'll get into an update on where things stand in Minnesota. Poly and perfluoroalkyl substances, because perfluorochemicals wasn't hard enough to say. PFASs, they're a large class, over 200 some surfactants with very unique chemical properties that make them resistant to heat, stains, oil, water, grease. So they have had a wide application both in consumer and industrial and manufacturing processes, and hence they've become widespread in the environment. They're essentially a carbon chain, just like all the hydrocarbons we've all been used to working with these many years, but all the hydrogen has been replaced, or some of the hydrogen in some instances, has been replaced with fluorine. And so we've had all these products. Some of the ones that are of most concern in terms of the impacts they've had and that we've been detecting in the environment are some of the non-stick coatings that are in a lot of consumer products like Gore-Tex, Teflon, you have Scotchgard, those sorts of things. Firefighting foams, which has now come to the fore in terms of site investigations throughout the country. And then chrome plating facilities, both here in Minnesota and across the nation. But you can see there's a lot of other widespread applications. Happily, even though I've got the microwave popcorn bag here, PFCs are no longer used in microwave popcorn bags. So those of you who don't like to stand shaking the pan on the stove, you can go back to your microwaves and eat what other horrible chemicals they've put into them. So what's up with this new naming thing? We've all been used to talking about PFCs, perfluorochemicals. Those are the fully fluorinated compounds. And you can see here, that went fast. A carbon chain, fully fluorinated, and then a functional group on the end. That's sort of the standard base PFC, and you're used to hearing about the ones that we have here in Minnesota, PFOA, PFOS, PFBA, PFBS, and so on. These are essentially non-degradable in the environment because of the strength of that carbon-fluorine bond. But we're now having to deal with what are called polyfluorinated compounds, which means they're partially fluorinated. So although the first one that I show here is fully fluorinated, all the carbons in the chain have a fluorine attached. In this example, which is a fluorotelomer sulfonate, you can see that some of the carbons are bonded to hydrogen, and that creates a weakness in that chemical structure that allows some of these compounds to degrade and eventually become PFCs, perfluorochemicals, and become persistent in the environment. And that has become an issue for us, and it accounts for why now in academia people are referring to PFASs rather than PFCs, because we have to be looking at the totality. The manufacture of these chemicals is a dirty process, is as most polymer science is. And so at a lot of these sites, what we're really dealing with is a mixture of both poly and perfluorinated chemicals. And starting in about 2015, we were hearing from researchers that the PFCs, the non-degradable ones, are the tip of the iceberg. What we're seeing is that our currently targeted analyte list, which is primarily focused on the PFCs, is only getting at about 10 to 20% of the fluorinated compounds that are at a lot of these sites, especially the firefighting foam sites or the AFFF sites. And we know this because of some new methodologies that have been developed, particularly in work being done at the School of Mines, Oregon State University, and some of the Canadian universities. And these new methods, some of them are actually older methods that have been reapplied, but total oxidizable precursor assay, or TOPS, quantifies these precursor chemicals that will break down to PFCs and can quantify them in groundwater, sediment, and soil. That's now being evolved and hopefully will be coming online more in the future. And then particle-induced gamma ray emissions, or PIGI, gives you total fluorine measures, so you can get a sense of what the mass of fluorinated compounds are at a site, but it has high detection limits, so it's really just a screening tool. But what they're doing is telling us we've got a bigger problem out there than we've realized to date. And it's raising new questions, especially from a policy perspective, in how do you respond once again to detecting a lot of chemicals for which we have no toxicological information or ecological impact information. What are we going to do? Are they a problem? Do we even know? And are these undetected precursors acting as ongoing sources to generate PFCs in the aquifers? So, you know, we're looking at the source areas, we're seeing a certain mass, these things are so incredibly mobile, why aren't they like leaving the source and going away, which we all kind of wish they would do, except perhaps what we've got are a lot more mass than we're aware of, and it's just generating more and more of, continuing to feed these plumes that we're dealing with. Very briefly, I mentioned PFCs behave in unique ways. Unlike a lot of the organic compounds that we're used to working with, they don't break down in the environment. Once you get down to those base structures, they just do not degrade. But unlike most persistent organic compounds, they're not readily absorbed to aquifer materials. And so they're incredibly persistent and they're incredibly mobile in the environment. And so there's a tiny bit of partitioning that we see going on based on the chain length and based on the functional groups. But primarily, these things get released and they get going, and they create very large plumes. The reason that the health department cares about all of this is the chemical structure is very similar to fatty acids. So you can see on the left is PFOA. Just an 8-carbon chain fully fluorinated with a carboxylic acid on the end. On the right is a common fatty acid, caprylic acid, an 8-carbon chain fully hydrogenated with a carboxylic acid functional group. Our body sees PFOA, says, I know what that is. It's caprylic acid. I'm going to grab onto it and use it. And so these things stay in our bodies for a long time. The half-lives on PFOA and PFOS are on the order of 3 to 4 years. PFHXS is actually on the order of something like 9 years of a half-life in the human body. And yet we still don't, on a national level, have any numbers for PFHXS. And even at the state level, we're just using a surrogate number. We use the PFOS number for PFHXS because they haven't done the studies on the darn stuff, even though it shows up in about 100% of people's blood when we look at the NHANES data. So we're way behind the curve on dealing with these things, and it's getting scary as we find more and more that we don't know enough about. So why did PFASs become a big deal all of a sudden again? I think Tracy the other day said to me, why do we keep calling these contaminants of emerging concern? We've been dealing with this stuff for a decade. But like other contaminants of emerging concern, they keep rearing their heads in new ways. One thing that happened was the EPA conducts their unregulated contaminant monitoring of municipal water supply systems. The last round that was released in 2015 included monitoring for the PFCs that you see on the screen here, PFOS, PFOA, PFBS, PFHXS, PFHPA, and PFNA, not PFBA, which is the one that's most widespread and most commonly detected in our groundwater, but has lower toxicity and so didn't make the cut. These samples for municipal systems are taken at the entry point, so they could be blended samples, so they're not necessarily worst case. They're not sampling the well. It's the entry point. And they detected PFASs in 20 states. And so all of a sudden last year, you started hearing states that had not dealt with PFASs before freaking out. Hoosick Falls up in New York, Colorado, who may now challenge us for the largest PFAS plume. They have an Air Force base in the Green River area that has contaminated the drinking water supply for hundreds of thousands of people. Michigan, Massachusetts, Vermont, Virginia, they're all now dealing with this. The detection rates were somewhat low. PFAS was found in 1.9% of public water supplies, PFOA at 2.2%. But the high, and I put that in quote, and I hate air quotes, but I do it anyways, the high reporting limits here, and now we're talking 10 to 90 nanograms per liter is a high detection or a reporting limit. Some researchers suggest that this may have resulted in underreporting of the actual presence of PFASs in public water systems. Andy Eaton at Eurofins Eaton Analytical did some really good data mining of the UCMR3 data and found that probably PFOA and PFAS are present in about 20% of the systems that were tested and PFHXS in about 10% if you look down at the 2.5 to 5 nanogram per liter level. And so most of us are saying, well, sure, if you go low enough, you're going to find stuff, right? And who cares? Well, word to the wise, New Jersey has just advised that PFOA should have a drinking water number of 14 nanograms per liter. And we all sort of rolled our eyes and said, well, that's New Jersey, right? They're always coming out with crazy low levels. But when you hear their explanation for why they think that, because of the way fetuses and breastfed infants or bottle-fed infants on being bottled-fed with formula made with contaminated water, the high level of uptake for them and the way that that persists in their body during really important developmental phases is pretty alarming. We've known for a long time that children and infants have much higher body burdens of perfluorochemicals than adults do. And now we're starting to understand why, and it's pretty scary. So 2.5 to 5 nanograms per liter may actually be a relevant level for knowing whether it's in city water or not. This map just gives you an indication of where PFAS and PFOA were detected. The red markers indicate where they were present at levels above the new EPA health advisory level. So this is a national issue. For a long time, we were told this is just Ohio, Minnesota, a couple places where they've got carpet manufacturers, but it really isn't. What we're seeing is the semiconductor industry, textile industries, the whole industrial Northwest, the chemical manufacturers, and then, of course, we've got our own legacy sites out in the East Metro and a firefighting site up in the Bemidji area. So on top of the UCMR3 data coming out and suddenly states who never thought they'd have to deal with this becoming aware of the PFAS problem, EPA also in May finally issued their new lifetime health advisories for PFAS and PFOA at 70 nanograms per liter, either individually or combined. This is one of the first times that we've seen EPA calling for additive assessments of chemicals because of the similar behavior of these. These are based on short-term exposure concerns for developing fetuses, infants, and children. Most of it's based on animal studies, but also human correlation studies that suggest developmental and immune system effects. So MDH is currently evaluating the EPA numbers. We are applying them now and using them in our standard additivity calculation with our other PFC numbers. We're using the 70 nanogram per liter value for PFAS as a surrogate for PFHXS in those additivity calculations. And we hope to establish health-based values for PFAS and new health-based values for PFAS and PFOA in early 2017. And it may be that we end up with numbers lower than 70 parts per trillion for these for at least PFOA, maybe PFAS. We'll see how the numbers play out. So that's what's new, and so old things become new again. We've been studying PFASs in the East Metro area now since 2003 because of the manufacture and then disposal of waste from the 3M plant in Cottage Grove, and most of you are pretty familiar with this map by now. The facility is on the river down here in Cottage Grove. Waste was disposed of in three major disposal areas in Oakdale, Lake Elmo, and on the border of Cottage Grove and Woodbury from the 1940s to the 1970s. The main chemicals of concern are PFAS, PFOA, PFBA, simply because it's so widespread, and PFHXS. Bedrock structures and groundwater in this area, even though it's your usual layer cake geology, there's some interesting structural geology in terms of the major northeast-southwest trending block faults associated with the St. Croix Anticline, creating a lot of vertical displacement that affects groundwater flow. Large former tributaries to both the St. Croix and the Mississippi, now buried valleys, but still acting as tributaries to those rivers and having big impact on groundwater flow, both in terms of channeled flow, but also all the karst development along those valleys when they were exposed creates almost immediate pathways into the bedrock from the unfortunate placement of three of the major sites right on top of the bedrock valley. And then tangentially, this site connected to that bedrock valley system by surface water flow that brings the contaminants over into Lake Elmo, and then they work their way into the bedrock valleys. There's a groundwater divide between the St. Croix and the Mississippi that allows groundwater to flow to the east out to the St. Croix and or to the southwest down to the south-southwest to the Mississippi. And unfortunately, because we've managed to bridge that divide with some of our water management programs up in this area, we have contamination on both sides of the divide. Most of you have seen this map. This is PFBA. I haven't had a chance to update my PFBA map, but it gives you an indication of the area. Over 100 square miles of contaminated groundwater impacting the drinking water of about 140,000 people in the East Metro. All four major aquifers, the St. Peter, Prairie du Chien, Jordan, and Franconia, or Tunnel City for you guys who are a little more up to speed than me, have been impacted. At least 1,500 private wells have been contaminated. We are rapidly increasing that number now that we have lower numbers to work with. So the PCA and the Health Department have been scrambling since the release of the new health advisory numbers from EPA with expanded investigations in the East Metro, which now includes West Lakeland Township, and aren't they glad to join the party? We're going to be sampling probably over 500 wells this fall and winter, and a shout-out to West Central and Interpol, whose staff are doing yeoman's work trying to get all this sampling done and now staring down the barrel of winter and trying to continue to sample private wells through the winter. And again, surface water transport is playing creating a major pathway that we're having to deal with. We've issued over 140 new well advisories, and that, I think, is just the beginning for us. Those folks are getting bottled water and then either being provided with carbon filters or are being hooked up to city water where that's available in a pretty limited stretch in Lake Elmo. And we're working with some affected public water systems to try and manage this situation. Oakdale, of course, has a treatment system, but now some of the wells that aren't run through that treatment system now exceed the new drinking water numbers, and so they're having to manage their pumping to try and control it. So John will be talking. Bemidji also has two wells that exceed the new health advisory levels from EPA, and we'll get to that in a minute. And Cottage Grove has three wells of their 11 that are kind of borderline to exceeding, and they've got the luxury they can shut those off and use other wells in the time for the time being until we figure out what to do. The Minnesota Public Health Laboratory has lowered their PFC reporting limits to help us be sure that we're catching enough of the contaminants to be able to evaluate them given these new low numbers. The reporting limits now, depending on which of the PFCs you're looking at, are anywhere from 25 to 35 parts per trillion. The detection limits are down between 5 to 18 parts per trillion. So we can get estimated concentrations quite a ways down there. So this is hot off the presses as of about 8 o'clock last night. Because the plumes have gotten so complicated, now I have to split it to north-south. So this is the north half of the East Metro area investigations. This is just PFOA. And you can see we've got a large plume heading out of the Washington County landfill and also out of the Oakdale disposal site. They're following the normal groundwater flow directions, except up here at the Washington County landfill, it also taps into one of those buried bedrock valleys, and so we've got a little finger of it that heads to the east, and apparently following it, it follows the bedrock valley along the west side of Sunfish Lake, and then down towards Lake Elmo. Here's Raleigh Creek draining the wetlands that were the disposal area in Oakdale. Moving to the east, it's a losing stream for most of its course, so it's contributing to the groundwater, discharging into Eagle Point Lake at the Park Reserve, and then because that's a closed lake, it re-enters the groundwater and then gets picked up in the regional flow and heads to the south. Southwest. And you can pick out what appears to be tracings of the joint patterns and the fractures in the bedrock that are paralleling those major fault systems. We also have flow through a buried valley connection between Eagle Point Lake and Lake Elmo. So Lake Elmo is contaminated above the new health advisory level for PFOA. Also for PFOS, I just don't have that map yet. And we knew about it, but it didn't seem to be of significant concern previously, but the Watershed District has a project called Project 1007 that also delivered water from Eagle Point Lake all the way over to Horseshoe Lake, where again it re-enters the groundwater. Now we're flowing to the east, and so that's the focus of some of our new investigation. So some of you have heard my talks before. You're familiar with this figure. It's just showing the groundwater-surface water interactions from the light blue is the groundwater, dark blue arrows are the surface water, the various pathways created by this groundwater-surface water system from the Oakdale disposal site and the Washington County landfill, all leading down to Eagle Point Lake and Lake Elmo and beyond. What we've got is a pipeline from Eagle Point Lake that goes across the bottom of Lake Elmo and then into a creek that eventually flows into Horseshoe Lake, which is on the old Tartan Park property over by the intersection of 10th Street and Manning. And so Project 1007, as Paul Harvey used to say, the rest of the story. From Lake Elmo, that goes through Horseshoe Lake, through a series of ditches and culverts, into a series of ponds running from the north to the south along Neal Avenue, then through a pipeline on the south side of the highway, and then into the rest area. At the rest stop, there's a lake, and then through some more ditches and culverts out to the St. Croix River. And our sampling from all the way from Lake Elmo through that system shows almost no reduction. It's as if the darn stuff can't even dilute as it travels, because the concentrations here of PFOA, PFOS, and PFBA are almost identical in this creek to what we find in the southernmost pond over here. And so this whole area is now an area of investigation of private wells because of the potential for this stuff to get back into the groundwater and impact private wells downstream of that system. This is the southern half of the East Metro. Again, here's the source areas at the Woodbury disposal site and the 3M plant itself. We also had a major chemical fire at a plastics manufacturer that may have contributed to some of this. This area, we'd already had lots of people on carbon filters and getting drinking water for their drinking water, but now we've expanded out onto Gray Cloud Island. And it's kind of hard to see, but the stuff goes right under the river, and we're picking it up in wells on the island itself. So it's an ongoing process. Meanwhile, the PCA and 3M have been busy. They've done a lot of additional cleanup actions. I won't go through all the details, but all four sites have had significant additional cleanup, enhancements to their pump-out systems, and we are seeing significant reductions at some of these sites in the concentrations in the groundwater. So things are getting better, but it's a long, slow process. I also mentioned drinking water treatment. We've got treatment on the Oakdale public wells, two of their wells, and then carbon filters for private homes that exceed the drinking water numbers. And the good news is, again, some good news, that seems to be having effect. This graph shows the concentrations of PFAS, PFOA, and PFHXS in the blood of people in the East Metro, and you can see a very good trend, downward trend, at the rate we would predict based on half-lives once we reduce or eliminate their exposure through their drinking water, which tells us that drinking water is their primary exposure. But you can see this is the national average shown in kind of this rusty red color. So the folks in the East Metro still have a higher body burden on average than the U.S. population. We've got other sites that we are now dealing with now that we're down to these low levels. The Bemidji Airport site, there were apparently, we now know there were two training areas. There was one right here, and we've just been advised that there was probably another one up in this area where AFFF, PFC-bearing AFFF, was used to train for fighting chemical fires and plane crashes. Unfortunately for Bemidji, they don't have tons of options for their drinking water, so their city wells are all here. This is it, their entire well field. The wells are about 120 to 150 feet deep in a water table aquifer. No real confining layer. And so, John, this is what I meant by they are pumping a plume through their city system. We've been sampling the private wells down gradient of it. So far, they're all clean. So literally, this is the pump-out system for that site. And we are the two southern wells, 4 and 7, are the ones that exceed the new health advisory levels. So we're working with the city to manage their system, to blend it, to get them below the new health advisory levels, which is never our preferred option. Blended water is not a real comfort to people who have to drink it. And so there's going to be more investigations ongoing in the next years. We'll be talking about what kind of treatment, because, you know, we don't even have the option of shutting these guys off. If we do, then we just pull the plume into the other ones and ruin them. So maybe new wells for Bemidji, maybe treatment, we don't know yet. The Duluth Air National Guard Base is another site, a firefighting training site that was investigated starting back. I think the investigation started earlier, but we got pulled in 2010. There's contamination of the groundwater near the training site, and then there's this whole area of wetlands to the north down gradient of the site, and the ditches and streams that drain that wetland are contaminated. Sampling of private wells in 2010 and 2011 in this area detected a few just, I think there were three or four that had trace levels of PFCs. We didn't think too much about it because they didn't exceed our drinking water numbers at the time. We've just resampled them. We're trying to evaluate that data. It came up a little off from what we were expecting, so we're trying to figure out where we're at, but this is going to be an ongoing investigation as well. So I'm going to wrap it up just by saying this is a problem that is not going away. It keeps reemerging in new and different ways. And because of all the states now concerned about this issue, a ITRC PFAS team has been formed and is going to be starting its work in January. They hope to be developing fact sheets and internet-based training modules. So keep your eye on that. If you're interested in participating in that, please get in contact. We're going to need as many people as we can helping out with the heavy lifting because there's a lot of ground to cover with that. I did want to acknowledge all the many, many people who are involved in these investigations, especially my colleagues over at the Pollution Control Agency. We've been going through the fire now for about 10 years, and as I mentioned, we've got some great folks at the consulting firms, West Central, Interpol, AECOM, helping out. The Minnesota Geologic Survey has been invaluable in helping us understand what's going on out there, and many, many more. So that's just my disclaimer that my bosses will disavow anything stupid I just said, and I'll be glad to take any questions.
So how many fire training sites are there in the state? And are all the landfills getting sampled at the new levels?
Yeah, so the question was how many firefighting sites are there, or fire training areas are there in the state, and are all the landfills being sampled? And, so here's one where I'm going to get to brag on Minnesota a little bit. And in part, I should have also mentioned in my list of acknowledgments, 3M has been a partner in all of this, and part of their consent agreement with the Pollution Control Agency provided a ton of funding to the state to investigate PFCs. And so we had the luxury, long before anybody else in the country, to go out and look for those firefighting sites. And the Pollution Control Agency, working with Delta, now Antia, I can't keep track, surveyed all the fire departments across the state. We also met with the fire marshal. Ultimately, we identified, I believe it was 70-plus sites where AFFF had been used in training activities. For most of the municipal sites, it was like 5 gallons a year. You know, they do a one-year training with the foam, and it wasn't that much. For other sites, like some of the big academies, like the WAFTA out in the West Metro area, where 16 fire departments would use that as their training site, there's significant contamination there. Fortunately, the geology of that site has kind of limited the impacts. So we did a prioritization based on the geology and the, you know, what have you, the usage and all of that, and then did sampling of wells near about, I think, 26 sites. There was contamination identified, but again, because of the limited volumes in most cases, there weren't significant impacts, trace levels in some wells that we tested, but nothing really big. The ones that came to light were the Bemidji and the Duluth Air National Guard, and we already knew about WAFTA. So landfills, yeah, the Pollution Control Agency early on did a lot of sampling at landfills. Pretty much every landfill, at least in the monitoring wells right up there, certainly in the leachate and the condensate, you're finding PFCs. And so it's gotten to the point that a lot of municipal wastewater treatment systems were starting to tell landfill operators, don't bring your leachate to us anymore. We don't want it, because the most municipal wastewater treatment will not remove PFCs unless they've got tertiary or quaternary treatment. And even then, you might be removing it out of the water, but you're not getting rid of them. So then they still have to deal with them somehow. So, yeah, it's out there.
Ginny, is the lab undergoing new method development to get some of the poly compounds in their methods now?
They are. They're scrambling right now just to keep up with all the sampling that we're doing. But they are looking at trying to bring in the total oxidizable precursor analytical methods. I would suspect in a couple years we're going to have that.
Yeah. I've heard that some of the chemical companies have the firefighting foam in systems that are put throughout the plants. Are you guys looking at those also?
There's my nightmare scenario, right? Because you can go online to YouTube and watch videos of guys testing out their fire suppression systems in warehouses. And then they open the doors to the warehouse and they hose it out into the storm sewer or into the pond next door or what have you. We haven't even been able to wrap our arms around that. The good news is the chemistry has shifted, and so most places are no longer using, certainly not the 6-carbon chemistry. That's no longer being used in firefighting foams. A lot of people still have a stockpile of it that's going to get used up and cause problems. But there are other forms of firefighting foams that people are now trying to use instead of this, largely because the firefighters insisted on it because they're exposed to it. I mean, there's one video on YouTube of a guy playing in the foam, no protective gear, no nothing. They're running through it. They're covered with it. It's just... Yeah, we can't even get our arms wrapped around where were the big chemical fires in over the last 50, 70 what years of, you know, there just aren't good records of that. So there are probably lots of little hot spots out there that will be discovered over time, usually, unfortunately, because we find it in somebody's drinking water and then trace it back.
Good. What's the nature of the health risk of these of this stuff at these concentrations?
Right.
Carcinogen? What?
These concentrations, we don't worry so much about cancer. Worker level kind of exposures, occupational exposures. There's some indication of slight increases in the rate of testicular, kidney cancers. There's indications of changes in cholesterol levels, which is kind of a marker for metabolic and endocrine system messing around. We're not really worried about healthy adults, is the bottom line, when we're talking about environmental exposures. It really is these short window during developmental phases for developing fetuses, infants, young children. And there's studies that are indicating, I mean, we've known for a while there's been studies showing lower overall birth weights and birth length for babies born to women with high levels of PFOA in their blood. Again, it's a correlation study. It's not a cause and effect kind of thing yet. But some of the animal studies are starting to focus in on cause and effect. Immune system suppression. So, you know, there was a study from the Faroe Islands that showed that children with higher levels of, I think it was PFOA, had less response when they had inoculations, indicating that their immune systems were suppressed. Thyroid problems are another thing at environmental exposure levels. So, unfortunately, it's a lot of stuff that we don't have population-based numbers to begin with, so we don't know what the baseline is, so we can't tell have we had health effects in the exposed populations because we don't have baselines to compare to. So those are the kinds of things that we're really concerned about. There's also some indication of early onset of adolescence for exposed children, some skeletal effects in animal studies. So it's a concern, but it's really hard to parse out when you're looking at the population.
Ginny, back here, two of the things we're uncertain about in the hydrogen, it's Tony.
Oh, hey.
Hi. two big uncertainties in the hydrogeologic system in the bedrock southeast Minnesota are the impact of faults on flow,
yeah,
as well as we really still don't have a good handle on aquitards and how well they really protect underlying the deeper aquifers.
The aquitardifers.
Yeah, exactly. And... So you know, obviously, I guess it goes without saying unfortunate circumstances, but it's really a unique data set in terms of a groundwater tracer to better understand how the flow system works.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, you mentioned faults briefly, but I couldn't tell in the small snapshot whether your data set indicates the faults are a barrier or a conduit to flow. And then the second question would be, you mentioned Tunnel City detects, whether that's giving you any indication of the integrity of the St. Lawrence, which elsewhere in southeast Minnesota is a pretty darn good aquitard, whether your Tunnel City detects are slow leakage through the St. Lawrence or just the nature of the three-dimensional system where they're, the contaminants are coming in erosional windows and then moving laterally to the, you know, beneath the St. Lawrence. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. And they're great questions, and we're kind of puzzling over them as well. It seems like in some places the faults are acting as barriers to flow. But in other places, I think what they're really doing is, you know, for the Tunnel City, there's places where we've got enough displacement that the Tunnel City's in contact with the Jordan. And so we're fairly confident in some places there's flow from the Jordan into the Tunnel City because of the faults. Other places, it's just really hard to tell. Is it that the St. Lawrence isn't competent, or is it just that stuff is getting down through the buried bedrock valleys and then out? There were, I guess, some of the new mapping you guys just did is showing that some of those valleys are deeper than we'd originally thought, and so that seems like it's even more of a possibility. But I think between the faulting that's fractured up and the, you know, not just these huge displacements, but then the associated smaller parallel and sub-perpendicular fractures and joint sets that's kind of chopped stuff up, I think the St. Lawrence just isn't as competent as we had once believed. Within the special well construction area, people now have to drill to the Tunnel City, and we do pick up perfluorochemicals in those new wells, even in areas we thought would be okay. They tend to decrease over time, so we're still trying to sort out, is it just cross-contamination during the drilling process, and then these things are so persistent, they're just not going away as fast as you'd normally expect, or are we seeing some migration into the Tunnel City? We just don't have enough information yet to know that, but it is worrying, because we don't have many other options out there for private wells.
Your presentation showed that the contaminants are removed from the water using carbon filters.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, what do you do with the carbon filters to dispose of the chemical?
Right. So there it is. There is no away, right? The only thing right now that we can do with perfluorochemicals is thermally degrade them. So if you heat them up to about 1,800 degrees centigrade, or 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, they'll thermally degrade. And so that's what's supposed to happen to the carbon filters, is that they're supposed to be thermally regenerated, and then the carbon itself is supposed to never be used for drinking water. It's supposed to then become applied only for industrial wastewater treatment purposes. Who's watching that? I don't know. Whether that's well managed or not is a good question. And that's for the systems that we're managing. There are lots of people putting in their own carbon filter systems, and what happens to that carbon? It used to be it went into the landfill, and I don't know that it doesn't still. So there's that. There is work being done now on ionic exchange resins that looks really promising, and what they would do then is they would extract the perfluorochemicals from the resins in a concentrate that could be treated. So the upfront costs look more expensive for installing systems like that, but the O&M on them looks like it'll be less expensive and better to control. There's one community in Long Island that's trying it out. We'll see how that works.
So along the lines of that last question, you showed some images where the plumes appear to be still having the highest concentrations near those landfills. Do you see any, I mean, it's a big task, but should we not be looking at remediating those landfills as a way to cut off the source? And yes, high costs, But what is that compared to losing the drinking water for basically the entire southeast part of the metro?
Amen. And that's why, you know, unfortunately, there is no in-situ treatment. So it's like we're back in the 80s. You can either dig it up or you can pump and treat. And that's what we're doing. So all of those sites had remedial actions in the 1980s. And here we are, just, I think, 2009 to 2011, additional excavations were done. The waste was pulled out and then put into triple-lined, essentially hazardous waste landfills that just aren't classified hazardous waste, with leachate collection and the works, and enhanced groundwater extraction with carbon treatment. So we are doing that, and we are actually seeing, especially at the Oakdale site, really good trends in the groundwater numbers. But as we all know, you can't get very far with pump and treat. I mean, it's a holding action at best. At the Woodbury site, we're pumping 4 million gallons a day, just trying to keep the stuff on the site, and that's just not sustainable. So the Department of Defense is pouring millions of dollars into research for in-situ treatment, and a lot of stuff is going to come online in the next 5 to 10 years is my expectation.